Our third case for argument this morning is United States against Pissman. Mr. Wise.
May it please the Court. Your Honor, Lance Pissman asked that this Court reverse his conviction on count three of his indictment in this case. In this case, the government's theory was that Lance Pissman's liability on the substantive offense charged in count three derived solely from his membership in the conspiracy that they had charged in count one. Their theory was a Pinkerton co-conspirator or vicarious liability theory. That being the case, the government had to prove that Lance Pissman was guilty of the conspiracy charged in count one to trigger the Pinkerton liability. The government acknowledged this early on in the case when they unveiled their theory at a motions hearing. They made it clear to the trial court, and the prosecutor told the trial judge, that the alleged co-conspirator's use of a computer form the acts which constituted the substantive offense that was charged in count three, and this prosecutor told the trial judge that the use of the computer was foreseeable and in furtherance of that conspiracy charged in count one, and in fact told the trial judge that in order to find Lance guilty of the conspiracy charged in count three, he must be found guilty of the substantive offense charged in count three. He must be found guilty of the conspiracy charged in count one. And that is exactly what this court has said about Pinkerton liability. In the Charez case, this court said, in order to convict under a Pinkerton theory, there must first be a conspiracy. I think that's a relatively elemental proposition of Pinkerton liability law. Another way this court said it is conspiracy
there's
is...
No. Doubt about this, counsel, but the jury was correctly instructed on count three and found with respect to count three that there was a conspiracy. It's the only basis of conviction. Your position seems to be that the acquittal on count one has priority over the conviction on count three. And that's, I don't understand why. The jury made inconsistent decisions. With respect to count one, it acquitted. With respect to count three, it convicted. It's logically inconsistent. There we are. Happens all the time.
This case is not an inconsistent verdicts case, and it's a
certainly
case...
Certainly it is. In order to convict on count three, it had to find that a conspiracy existed. In order to acquit on count one, it had to find that it didn't exist, or at least that it hadn't been proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And it found both things. That it did and that it didn't.
No, this jury found that there was no conspiracy. At that point, under
on count one and on count three, it found there was a conspiracy.
Well, the way they're instructed, and if you look at the Stott case. In the Stott case, this court looked at this issue from an angle that I think that is particularly instructive. The court observed that the Pinkerton instruction in that case, and it was just the exact same instruction that was given in this case, required the jury to find...
But you're not challenging the validity of the instruction.
No, the instruction is
instruction is fine.
Yes.
Therefore, in order to convict on count three, the jury had to find that your client entered into the conspiracy, and it did so fine because it convicted on count three. That's why we have inconsistent verdicts.
And this is also why...
Let me give you an example. Okay. And suppose there are two defendants. One is charged with defrauding the government, and defendant number two is charged with aiding and abetting defendant number one to defraud the government. And defendant number one is acquitted. Defendant number two is convicted. You think the conviction of defendant number two can stand on your view? Because, number one, the guy who's the substantive claim actually defrauding the government is acquitted. No substantive crime to aid and abet.
That is a perfectly legitimate result, because in each case the jury is instructed.
I think your position is that, exactly, defendant number two has to be acquitted. The Supreme Court, of course, held opposite in Standifer against the United States.
In the scenario that you're giving, each defendant, the jury would be instructed in each case that the defendant has to participate in the offense. This is a vicarious.
What the jury found was there was no offense at all, and defendant number two aided and abetted it.
Right. So the jury had to find that he participated in acts that led to the aiding and abetting. Whereas here, a jury in a Pinkerton liability case, the jury is expressly told, and in this instruction, they were expressly told that Mr. Pizman does not have to participate in the acts which constitute the substantive offense. That's the distinction between your aiding and abetting situation. Here they are told you have to be if he was found guilty of the conspiracy charged in count one, and when the jurors acquitted, as in Stott, this court said the jury had no business applying the Pinkerton instruction.
Mr. Wise, I think we should go on to the disparity in sentences, because your time is running out. And I, for one, am really wondering why you want to, in considering the disparity in sentencing, isn't the proper focus on sentence disparity with other sentences nationwide rather than a case-specific factor as we have here?
That is one factor, Your Honor, and the judge, in this case, the standard we're dealing with is a standard of reasonableness in the judge's sentence. The judge considered the internal disparity as one factor in sentencing, and among many, he considered.
Well, given that the district court stated that Mr. Pissman's sentence would have been higher if Mr. Wilkerson's was higher, isn't it clear that the disparity issue was the determinative factor in the reduced sentence?
I don't think that's clear at all. The judge relied on many factors that...
all of the other factors the judge mentioned would have led your client to get an even higher sentence. Your client didn't accept responsibility, that he was unreasonably denying his role. The district judge found that your client had committed perjury. You know, all of those things call for a higher sentence, not a lower sentence.
He also... Well...
Let me ask another variation of my colleague's question. We held in United States against Meza that a co-defendant's lower sentence, justified by assisting the prosecutor, is not a good reason to lower a given defendant's sentence. The district judge didn't mention Meza. You don't mention Meza. How are we to apply Meza here?
The judge also,
Do you think Booker changed the result of Meza? The question I'm asking is, if we hold before Booker that a given consideration is not a legally good one, does Booker change the outcome? Does it become legally good after Booker if it was a legally bad consideration before Booker?
I don't think Booker changes that outcome of the Meza case, but you have to factor in that that wasn't what
if you don't think Booker affects Meza, and that I suppose that's right, because Booker is about who finds facts rather than about what legal considerations matter, then we're in a position where the district court seems to have violated the principle of Meza without even discussing it, without suggesting that one of the 3553A factors overrides Meza. And you, of course, have chosen utterly to ignore that case. You know, what doesn't that leave your client kind of up the creek?
No, because The judge found a myriad of other factors regarding Mr. Wilkerson. He found, for instance, that Mr. Wilkerson was a far more culpable and dangerous person than Mr. Pizman. That
but
alone.
That's where his error came in.
Yeah.
He.
That's problem.
Exactly the point. You
that's
see.
That's the Mesa problem.
No, the Mesa.
The Mesa problem arises when somebody who is more culpable gets a lower sentence because he cooperated with the prosecutor. And we said in that circumstance, that is not, as a matter of law, a good reason to reduce the sentence of somebody who fails to cooperate with the prosecutor. That's the holding of Mesa. And you've just told me you think Booker doesn't affect Mesa. Well, we've just got Mesa again on that view.
You look at the sentence under Booker, under the totality of the circumstances reasonableness standard, and when you look at it that way, and you apply that standard, when the judge considered all the factors, considered factors favoring a sentence under the that would be consistent or with the guideline what the guidelines the guideline sentence, and he considered many factors that could result and did result in a much lower sentence.
Look, it's my view at any rate that we can't uphold this sentence as reasonable based on the other factors that the district court considered, because those factors, for instance, the criminal history was already considered in determining the advisory guideline range and wouldn't justify a departure this extreme. And because the district court made it absolutely clear that the sentence was tied to the disparity issue, actually saying that Pizman's sentence would have been higher if Wilkinson's had been, if we went along with the district court's view, that narrow focus of the district court really could, in fact, create sentencing disparities with other similarly situated nationwide. I mean, it's a real problem here.
I think you have to look at the judge's, the Booker requires that you look at the totality of all the factors the judge relied on. You look at his calculus, you rely on the judge's wisdom and in that sense the sentence that Judge McDade gave is reasonable, but I maintain in the first argument that the acquittal on count one precluded the application of Pinkerton liability. It is an irrational verdict under the Jackson versus Virginia standard.
Let me restate once more what I understand my colleague's question to be, and mine too. Let's imagine another person who is absolutely identically situated to Pizman, but he's on trial, he's charged in Chicago or Des Moines, and he doesn't have a co-defendant. But he does just exactly what Pizman did. And he also lies and doesn't cooperate and doesn't plead guilty and all of those things. What should his sentence be? Should it be 60 months? Or should it be, the middle, someplace in the normal guideline range? What happened in this case, the district judge is saying Pizman's sentence should be lower because he's lucky, because his co-defendant cooperated, or because he had a co-defendant. But wouldn't that, in the end, increase sentencing disparity nationwide? Because now two defendants in the Central District of Illinois are getting a break rather than one, and we now have even more disparity compared to how an identically situated person in Chicago or Dubuque is being treated.
Each situation is fact-specific. And you can't avoid the issue of that.
You might want to deal with my question.
I am.
How should the person in Chicago be treated? What sentence should he get? identically situated to Pisman, but without having the luck of a co-defendant who pleads guilty and cooperates.
He should receive the sentence that the trial judge finds is reasonable. I see my time is up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Wise.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jan Miller. I represent the United States in this case, and I would like to focus on the sentencing issue. There is one thing that defense counsel has stated here that I agree with, and that is that Judge McDade considered all of the 3553A factors, but I also agree with the observations from the court, and that is the only factor that he ended up taking into account was the what the government believes is a warranted disparity here. And I think that, therefore, leads to the question of what specific type of remand the government is asking for in this case. Obviously, this court is aware that you have great discretion in how broad or narrow a remand you were to order, and, of course, the government's position here is that the sentence was unreasonable and requires a remand, and I'd be happy to answer any questions regarding that issue. But jumping ahead to the scope of the remand, I am aware that in some sentencing cases where, for example... Yes, sir?
You don't necessarily want to leap to the fact of remand. The government violated Circuit Rule 30A and Circuit Rule 30C in this case by not filing a proper appendix. There is a dispute in this case about what the district judge did rely on. And in order to figure that out, we need to be able to turn to the appendix of the appellant. The rule couldn't possibly be clearer that you have to provide, bound with your brief, a copy of the district court's explanation of the judgment for which review is sought. And the United States violated that.
Yes, Your Honor.
And why shouldn't we just dismiss your cross-appeal?
Well, Your Honor, we did ask. There was no excuse for violating that rule. I apologize to the court for that. We recognized our error last week in preparation.
A little late, I must say.
Yes.
We all prepared for this case earlier. Some of us struggled. There's only one copy of the record. It can be in only one place at a time. You've got three judges. And, of course, even after you file this supplemental document, which doesn't itself comply with the rule, there's now a motion to strike it on the ground that doesn't contain all of the district judge's explanation.
Well, I would disagree with that ground for the striking it, Your Honor. I think it does contain all of the reasons for the judge's explanation. It starts, the judge's explanation is essentially from pages, I believe, 93 to 98 or so. I'd have to look at the exact pages, and those are in the supplemental appendix that we filed. There is no excuse for the violation of the rule, Your Honor. I don't have an answer to that. It was an oversight that should not have occurred. It's as simple as that. Your Honor, there are circumstances I know where this court has, in remanding cases for sentencing, left it wide open for the sentencing court. For example, where there are multiple counts of conviction and overturning a sentence on one count might unbundle the sentencing, and the district court, therefore, should have the right to reopen everything, or where there are factual disputes that still need to be resolved. I would submit in this case that there is no reason for such a wide-open remand from this court. As this court has observed already this morning, Judge McDade did go through the various factors, made findings regarding those factors, and the only factor that he relied on was the disparity. And as this court has observed, all of the other findings on all the other factors, in fact, would call for a higher sentence. Moreover, there were 20-some-odd objections to the pre-sentence report in this case. The judge ruled on all of those. The defendant made presented witnesses, et cetera, et cetera. Essentially, the government's position in this appeal is that everything that needs to be done was done, except there was an error in applying the one issue regarding disparity of the sentencing. And so the government, in asking for a remand in this sentencing, would request that this court give very specific instructions and a limited remand to the court below. And that is that the sole factor in this case, as this court has suggested this morning, is improper under Meza, that therefore this sentence was unreasonable, that all of the other factors have already been determined by the district court, and that there is no factor in this case that would call for a sentence outside of the advisory guideline range, and that the sentence should be that the defendant should therefore be resentenced accordingly. As I said, I recognize that there are a variety of ways that that can be done, but I think the bottom line is, because of the record in this case, because of all the evidence and arguments that were made below.
But, Mr. Miller, aren't we now supposed to give the judge an opportunity to rethink in toto? In other words, would it be fair to only, you know...
Maybe
he slept on it since Booker. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's got a whole other view since Booker. Would it be fair to tie the judge's hands only to the pronouncements
that he
made previously when we're remanding?
Well, of course, this was post-Booker. The sentencing was post-Booker, so Booker case itself he had already taken into account. I'm sorry, Your Honor, go ahead.
He had taken into account Booker, but not all of the, you know, post-Booker cases that have, you know, been coming out of this court like birds flying in the skies.
Well, I think that the guidance that this court has given, I guess my short answer is no, I don't think this is a situation, again, because of the state of the record in this case. I don't think that this is a situation that needs to be reopened entirely. This court has given direction to the district court judges in Mikhaydiuk and Dean and George and those various cases regarding what they should be looking at and what this court will be looking at in determining if a sentence is reasonable or not. I think that in a situation like this, where there was evidence taken, where the judge made findings already regarding virtually all of the 355-3A factors, he didn't list them seriatim, but when you read through it, he talked about the dangerousness and the seriousness of the offense.
But I have no doubt that your office will be in here on another case asking us to do exactly the opposite if the judge said things like, you are the most sympathetic person I have ever come across. My heart is broken. I wish I could do something for you. I see your mother sobbing out there.
Well,
I'm just repeating some of my old sentences, but I have no doubt that you'd be in here on, you know.
I'm not sure, Your Honor. Obviously, it would depend on the state of the record and exactly what the judge said. And I think, frankly, it would be completely disingenuous.
Whether you check that the mother is a real mother and not an actor.
Yes. Well, if there were new facts that were, through no fault of counsel, unavailable at the time of sentencing, that might be a factor. There is no indication of that here. Now, we'd have to wait and see, obviously, if it went down below. But in a situation where due diligence had been done by both sides and there was no additional information to gather, I think that's a different situation. I understand, Your Honor, that you might not be inclined for that approach, but I can't say what our position would be. I think it would be disingenuous, frankly, for us to be here, even if we were asking for a sentence under different circumstances, if there were still factual disputes, and if it was relatively unclear from the judge's statements why he gave the sentence, or if there were multiple factors, certainly if there were multiple factors given and only several of them or one of them was inappropriate. That's also a situation where most likely it would be unfair to go back with a more limited remand. In this case, though, on this record, where the judge made it abundantly clear that there was one reason and one reason only, I would submit that it would be appropriate to have a very strict remand in this case. Unless there are any further questions, I have nothing else to add to our brief.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Miller. Anything further, Mr. Wise?
I'll address Judge Rovner's question, and with the understanding, and I know there is, I know what rebuttal means, and I'm not going to address the insufficiency of the evidence issue, but if the case is remanded, and it shouldn't be, but this court deems that appropriate, then it's then when the issue is the reasonableness of a sentence, then the then it's opened up again to the evidentiary hearing. It comes back, and the judge, as Judge Rovner indicated, Judge McDade should have the ability to apply his post-Booker wisdom to the case, and it comes back in a much different scenario than it was when the sentencing hearing was held. There was a insufficiency of the evidence issue that was going to be appealed, and in that light, the sentencing evidence was a little bit more narrow. If it comes back and there's a conviction, then the judge then we can take that into account, and the judge can take his post-Booker wisdom into account, and if there's a remand, it should be a remand as you've suggested, but I don't think there should be. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Wise. The case is taken under advice.